This is Lecture 8 in the series Inflation and Price Controls.
Before I begin, I would like to make a few announcements. First, if you're following the brochure which you received when you first heard about this course, I have made a change in the organization between Lectures 8 and 9. I've moved the discussion of socialism's destruction of freedom into Lecture 9, and I have moved the material from Lecture 9, or most of the material, pertaining to the economic failure of socialism into tonight's lecture. All right, with that said, we can begin. Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. In the last two lectures, I have shown how price controls cause chaos in production and distribution. At the end of last week's lecture, I explained how partial price controls lead to universal price controls. Tonight, I will show how universal price controls greatly increase the disruption of production that we observed under partial controls, and how they are capable of causing cumulative, self-reinforcing declines in production to the point of totally destroying the economic system. I will then show how, in an effort to deal with the chaos and destruction it causes through price controls, the government is led to impose still further controls, namely controls on every aspect of production and distribution. I will show why, together with price controls, these additional controls constitute the de facto socialization of the economic system. At that point, we will be ready to start on an analysis of the economics of socialism, which, as I say, is the climax of price controls. Let us begin. Please recall from last week that the government's purpose in imposing universal price controls is to prevent the destruction of vital industries, the vital industries that it initially brings under controls. Controls are imposed on the prices that constitute the production costs of these industries in order to assure them an adequate rate of profit. Controls are extended to the selling prices of all other industries in order to restrain their rate of profit in relation to that of the controlled industries. As illustration, simply recall our discussion last week of the process whereby the present price controls on oil could be extended to all prices and wages in the economic system. Observe that it is perfectly possible under universal controls for all industries to be guaranteed not only approximately equal rates of profit, but rates of profit that by historical standards are relatively high in nominal terms. This is possible because the government controls all the prices that constitute costs, including wages, which are the fundamental element in costs. Nevertheless, as we will see, no matter how high the nominal rate of profit the government allows, vital industries are still destroyed, and production is disrupted far more seriously than under partial price controls. What destroys production under universal controls is the consequences of the shortages they create. I will repeat, what destroys production under universal controls is the consequences of the shortages they create. In the last 2 weeks, we have seen a variety of ways in which shortages disrupt production under partial controls. I will briefly recount them because all of them apply under universal controls. Please recall in this recounting, by the way, that anything that acts to raise costs implies a decline in production. One, shortages make buyers impotent and thereby remove the incentives of sellers to provide good quality and service. As a result, quality and service decline, and the costs of maintenance and replacement increase. Two, shortages of means of production, such as a material, often force sellers to reduce quality and service and make it necessary to resort to more expensive substitute methods of production. Three, shortages encourage sellers to concentrate on the production of unnecessarily expensive models as a disguised way of raising prices. Four, shortages create a positive incentive to using more expensive methods of production if the government allows the pass-through of higher costs and makes the incurrence of higher costs a source of higher profits. I won't go through this very slowly because I'm just repeating what we have covered in the last two lectures, so you could refer back to your notes. Five, shortages result in delays in production. Six, shortages cause hoarding and the construction of additional storage facilities. Seven, shortages cause the waste of time in searching for supplies. Eight, shortages cause chaos in the geographical distribution of a good among local markets, for example, gasoline during the oil shortage. Nine, shortages create chaos in the distribution of a factor of production among its various employments in production, for example, crude oil in the production of the various oil products, as we saw last week. Now, under a system of universal price controls and universal shortages, these elements of chaos apply to all industries instead of to just a few industries. In addition, they apply more strongly to each industry than if that industry were the only industry under price controls, or if price controls were confined to it and just a few others. I want to elaborate on this point about the greater intensity of the problems facing a controlled industry as a result of controls being universal. Observe, first of all, that the excess demand confronting each industry is far greater than under partial price controls, because it is compounded by the excess demand for all other products, as we saw last week. The greater severity of the shortage of a product under universal controls creates correspondingly more severe problems in connection with that product. As just one illustration, consider the case of cotton and cotton products. If the price of cotton and cotton products were the only controlled prices in the economic system, there would be a problem of using too much cotton to produce shirts, say, and not enough to produce other cotton products, or vice versa. Because similarly to what we saw last week in the case of crude oil, there would be a shortage of each cotton product. And so more of any one cotton product could be produced at the expense of the others without reducing its price and profitability. As I say, this is the same principle we saw last week in the case of gasoline production being expanded at the expense of heating oil and vice versa. Remember, more supply does not reduce prices when a shortage exists. It just alleviates the shortage. And less supply does not raise prices when prices are controlled. Hence, the distribution of a factor of production such as crude oil, or now cotton, among its various products becomes chaotic. Thus, to continue, if shirts, cotton, and the other cotton products were the only controlled goods, the increase in shirt production would be limited by the fact that people could spend their money on other goods. Beyond a point, people would only be willing to buy additional shirts that made people would only be willing to buy additional shirts at prices that made any further increase in shirt production unprofitable. however low the price of raw cotton might be controlled. But if everything is controlled and people have no other goods available on which to spend their money than shirts, there is no reason why they would not buy enough shirts to have two or three new ones to wear every day, if there were that many available. People would be willing to go on buying more shirts so long as extra shirts had an intrinsic utility greater than that of paper money. They would be willing to buy them as a source of cleaning rags, buttons, pins, or whichever, that otherwise might be unobtainable. They would buy them to hold merely as a source of a store of value in the future. They would buy them merely to hold as a store of value in the future, because holding them would be better than holding the otherwise unspendable money. The principle that emerges is that under universal controls, it becomes practically impossible to eliminate the shortage even of any individual good by means of expanding its production. This is because each good is confronted with the excess demand of the whole economic system. There is a second reason why the elements of chaos connected with partial controls must apply more strongly under universal controls. And that is the fact that each industry must suffer the consequences of shortages in its capacity as a buyer. Indeed, it must suffer them in everything it buys. For example, under universal controls, not only does chaos reign for the customers of the oil industry, but the oil industry itself now encounters the same chaos in its own purchases of pipeline, drilling equipment, trucks, tankers, and of course, labor services. Whatever problems the oil industry had before are now intensified. And of course, the excess demand confronting the oil industry is expanded by the spillover of unsatisfied demand from every other fuel and chemical for which petroleum products could substitute. It is also expanded by the sheer desire of people to own any storable physical good in preference to unspendable paper money. Now, not only do universal price controls spread chaos through the whole economic system and intensify it, as we have just seen, but as a consequence, they add a wholly new dimension to the chaos that we have not previously encountered. Namely, they create shortages of capital and labor, the two factors of production required by every industry. These shortages exist because the shortages of consumers' goods create a ready and waiting employment for more capital and labor in every industry. If there's a shortage of each consumer's good, then every industry can use more capital and labor. And as a result, the distribution of capital and labor among the various industries is made random. Capital and labor are made to stand in the same relation to all the different industries that we have seen crude oil or raw cotton stand in relation to their respective products. What this means is that capital and labor can be withdrawn from any industry or placed in any industry, and there is no effect on the rate of profit anywhere. Observe, if capital and labor are withdrawn from any industry, price controls prevent prices and profits in that industry from rising. If additional capital and labor are invested in any industry, shortages prevent prices and profits in that industry from falling. All that happens is that the shortage in the industry is reduced. For example, if capital and labor are withdrawn from making paper and transferred to making pots, price controls prevent the price and profitability of paper from rising, while shortages prevent the price and profitability of pots from falling. The consequence of this state of affairs is that production from industry to industry becomes utterly chaotic. not only can any product of crude oil be randomly expanded at the expense of any other product of crude oil, not only can any product of cotton be randomly expanded at the expense of any other product of cotton, but any product anywhere in the economic system can be randomly expanded at the expense of any other product anywhere else in the economic system. The chaos is total. Let us begin to understand the significance of this. Assume the consumers would prefer to have more shoes and fewer shirts. Under price controls, they cannot bid up the price of shoes and increase the profitability of shoe production. At the same time, as a result of universal shortages, they will not decrease their purchase of shirts because they have no alternative use for the money. In fact, in this situation, it is perfectly possible that capital and labor could be withdrawn, unchecked, from shoe production, which the consumers want more of, and added on, unchecked, to shirt production, which they want less of. That is, that the exact opposite of the consumers' wishes could occur. Because if this perverse result did occur, price controls would prevent the price and profitability of shoes from rising to stem the withdrawal of capital and labor from the shoe industry. At the same time, the existence of a shortage would prevent the price and profitability of shirts from falling to stem the inflow of capital and labor into the shirt industry. Indeed, this perverse result is not only possible, but fully as likely as that the consumers will get the result they want. Under universal price controls, there is no longer any connection between the consumers' preferences and business firms' profits or losses. In an economy in which there are universal shortages, the consumers are ready to buy anything. And that makes it possible for businessmen to produce anything. I leave it to your imagination to think of what kind of deterioration in quality and service can take place in this kind of situation, and of all of the other inefficiencies that can exist. It should already be clear that the extent to which this perverse process can be carried, namely the process of consumers getting goods they want less at the expense of goods they want more, has no limits under universal price controls. No matter how bad the shortage of a particular good becomes as the result of a decrease in its production, price controls prevent its production from becoming more profitable. No matter how much the production of a particular good is increased, its shortage is so severe that practically no amount of additional production will eliminate it, because its shortage reflects the spillover of unsatisfied demand from the whole economic system. In this way, universal price controls have the effect of flooding people with shirts while making them go barefoot, of inundating them with shoes while making them go shirtless, of giving them enormous quantities of writing paper but no pens or ink, or vice versa, of giving them food but no clothing, or clothing but no food, of giving them toothpaste but no soap, or soap but no toothpaste, or indeed of giving them any absurd combinations of goods. And at any moment, the positions of the goods can be reversed, with the relatively abundant ones suddenly disappearing, while the ones previously impossible to find suddenly appear in abundance. These conditions, I should point out, are not a mere theoretical projection, but the normal, the chronic conditions of Soviet Russia ever since the Communist Revolution. There is no connection in Soviet Russia between production and the desires of the consumers. And everything produced for the individual consumers in Soviet Russia is simply junk. Now, this kind of chaos in production is the source of drastic declines in production. First of all, merely giving consumers unbalanced combinations of goods is itself equivalent to a major decline in production. because to be given less necessary products at the expense of more necessary products represents just as much a loss in human well-being as an actual decline in the physical volume of production. For example, imagine that a dozen shirts represents the same physical volume of production as three new pair of shoes in terms of the capital and labor that must be employed to produce them. Suppose further that what I want each year is a dozen shirts plus three pairs of shoes. If I end up having to settle for two dozen shirts and go barefoot, I am obviously much worse off than if I could have gotten eight shirts and two pair of shoes, or even just four shirts and one pair of shoes. Observe, the same overall volume of physical production becomes equivalent to a smaller physical production by virtue of its being improperly proportioned to people's different wants and needs. However, this kind of chaos in production does not merely cause chaotic combinations of consumers' goods. It also causes chaotic combinations of capital goods. And in so doing, it reduces the economic system's overall physical ability to produce. An economic system's ability to produce does not depend merely on the quantity of its capital goods, but no less on the proper distribution of that overall quantity among the various specific types of capital goods. If, for example, the steel industry is unduly expanded at the expense of the coal industry, say, or vice versa, the economic system's subsequent ability to produce will be impaired. Not only the extra steel mills, but part of the existing steel mills will be inoperable for a lack of fuel. An economy's overall ability to produce must be thought of in terms analogous to the functioning of an organism. It depends on the smooth coordination and adjustments of all of its parts. Like a human body, whose total performance cannot exceed the power of its brain, heart, lungs, or any other vital organ, the overall performance of an economic system cannot exceed the power of any one of a large number of vital industries. If some are expanded at the expense of others, the effect is to reduce the functioning of the whole. Indeed, every malproportion has serious consequences. Consider the devastating effects on production, not only of disproportions among whole major industries like steel and coal, but of disproportions in the output of individual industries. For example, the production of too many trucks to haul farm products and of not enough tractors to harvest them. Consider the effects on production of disproportions in the production of just a few key products here and there, like ball bearings, lubricants for machinery, spare parts, even ordinary screws, and so on. A shortage of any one of these items, or a shortage of any one special type of these items, such as ball bearings of a special size, must cause a wide paralysis and the grossest inefficiencies in production. And of course, improper geographical distribution of these or any other inputs has equally devastating consequences on production. For the mere existence of a thing is of no value if the producers who need it are prevented from obtaining it. The same is true if anything is unavailable for production because it is being hoarded. These declines, of course, are all further compounded by the declines that result from producers just not having to care any longer about the quality of their products or about economies in producing them. Again, this chaos is not a mere theoretical projection, but an actual description of the chronic conditions of Soviet Russia. In Soviet Russia, hydroelectric stations are built without generators and without the existence of industries to supply. Wheat cannot be harvested because the necessary tractors have not been built, or if they have been built, they lack spare parts or are in the wrong place. Factories cannot operate because they lack materials. New buildings and new machines are worthless because of shoddy construction due to lack of care or lack of the necessary materials. Now, the declines in production resulting from all these causes tend to be self-reinforcing and cumulative. Please observe that in the course of production, capital goods are physically consumed. Materials and fuel are used up, and machinery and buildings wear out. If production is to be maintained, the capital goods used up in production must be replaced. The only source of replacement, however, is production itself. That is, the capital goods consumed in production in an economic system can be replaced only out of that system's production. But if that production declines sufficiently because of economic chaos, then it will not be possible to reproduce the capital goods consumed in production. As a result, the stock of capital goods will fall. Once that happens, production must decline further because it will be carried on with less capital goods. If the smaller supply of capital goods is used as inefficiently as was the larger supply because of continuing chaos in production, it will not be possible to replace the smaller supply of capital goods either. And so once again, production will decline. And this process of less production causing less capital goods, causing less production, can go on until the economic system is carried back all the way to the level of barbarism. To make this process more concrete, just think of the fact that in the course of production, such things as steel mills, cement factories, freight cars, and so on, are wearing out and must be replaced. The only way to replace them is out of the economy's current production. If that production declines sufficiently because of economic chaos, then it will not be possible to replace them. The result will be that in the future, production will have to be carried on with fewer steel mills, cement factories, and so on. And then even the smaller number of steel mills, etc., will not be able to be replaced because, given the continuation of chaos, the output that is obtained from them will be too low. I now want to give special consideration to the shortage of labor that universal price controls create. The labor shortage introduces a second powerful factor, making for a self-reinforcing cumulative decline in production. Observe, under universal controls, the shortage of consumers' goods causes a shortage of labor. Every industry is eager to employ more labor because whatever extra products it can produce with more labor will be snapped up by goods-hungry buyers. The labor shortage is intensified by the declines in efficiency that price controls create, because these declines in efficiency mean that it takes more labor on average to produce a unit of goods. As a result of the labor shortage, employers are even led to, quote, hoard labor. That is, keep it on the payroll in idleness or semi-idleness in order to have it available when they need it. This, of course, only intensifies the labor shortage. Now, what is of special importance is that the labor shortage not only exists because of an excess demand for labor. It very soon becomes compounded by a falling supply of labor. The supply of labor begins to fall as the result of shortages of consumers' goods. These shortages destroy the incentive to work. As people accumulate surplus, unspendable income, it begins to occur to them that they need not earn money they cannot spend. They lose the incentive to advance because earning more money is useless to them. They cease to care about being fired because not only can they immediately find another job if they wish it, but the loss of income they cannot spend does not affect them. They begin to do their jobs badly. They become willing to settle for lower level, less demanding jobs that pay less. They quit their jobs altogether and live off their forced savings for extended periods before taking another job. All of these things represent a decline in the supply of labor. And of course, they cause a major decline in production and thus in the supply of consumers' goods. This decline in the supply of consumers' goods makes the shortages of consumers' goods still worse, and thereby further reduces the incentives to work, which, of course, causes even worse shortages. And so it goes until, in fairly short order, production must come to a total halt. Again, it is worth noting that Soviet Russia is characterized by a labor shortage, in which factory managers hoard labor in order to be sure of fulfilling their quotas under the official economic plan. The shortages of consumers' goods in Russia also contribute to the labor shortage. Now, something that is truly remarkable about universal price controls is that, at least in their earlier stages, they can create a delusion of prosperity, even while production is becoming chaotic and on the road to collapse. For observe, under universal price controls, any businessman can find a ready and eager market for any merchandise, no matter how poorly it is produced. All he has to do is produce something of greater intrinsic utility than paper money. In the process, he can even make large nominal profits, simply by virtue of the government having controlled at an appropriate level the prices that constitute his costs. By the same token, the labor shortage makes it possible for any worker to obtain immediate employment in any occupation for which he is even remotely qualified. To those who confuse going through the motions of production with real production, and who confuse the earning of mere paper money with the acquisition of real physical wealth, this situation looks like prosperity. What they see is that business is humming, everyone is employed who cares to be, and everyone is making money. Just this situation characterized the United States during World War II. The combination of massive inflation to pay for the war and universal controls to hide the symptoms of the inflation quickly produced widespread shortages, including a labor shortage. Most people mistook this situation for prosperity. Nevertheless, despite a superficial appearance of prosperity, the real standard of living of the American people fell drastically during World War II. It fell to a level far below the worst years of the Depression. In the worst years of the Depression, 3/4 of the American labor force was employed, and everyone who was working could buy anything he wanted commensurate with his earnings. During World War II, no one could buy a new car, a new house, or a new major appliance of any kind. The government had prohibited their production altogether. In addition, many of the most common everyday goods simply became unobtainable, or obtainable only with great difficulty, such as chocolate bars, chewing gum, sugar, meat, nylon stockings, gasoline, rubber tires, and so on. The goods that were obtainable badly deteriorated in quality. Everyone recognized the difference between what they called pre-war quality and wartime quality. People believed that they were prosperous in World War II because they were piling up large amounts of unspendable income in the form of paper money and government bonds. They confused this accumulation of paper assets with real wealth. And incredibly, most economic statisticians and historians make the same error when they measure the standard of living in World War II by the largely unspendable, quote, national income of the period. And this, I should say, incidentally, is the liberals' idea of prosperity. They always refer to World War II as a kind of golden era of full employment. That is their notion of prosperity. The controls did not last long enough in this country to wreck the economic system. And their effect was further mitigated by the fact that we entered the war with mass unemployment and a large amount of idle plant capacity. The absorption of these factors into production made it possible to offset much of the wastes and inefficiencies resulting from the controls. They constituted a kind of reserve fund, as it were, out of which much of the costs of the controls were met. Also, during the war, people were highly motivated by considerations of patriotism and were not only willing to tolerate the hardships imposed by the war, but actually to work longer and harder. Many of them reasoned that if the soldiers at the front could risk their very lives in the defense of civilization, they could do with less goods and put in an extra effort at work. Finally, no one regarded the controls as a permanent institution. Everyone looked forward to a quick end to the war and to the opportunity to spend after the war. Such things, however, can at best only delay the full consequences of universal controls. In the present circumstances, moreover, no such mitigating factors are present. Now, we have seen the chaos the government creates through price controls. In an effort to deal with this chaos, the government adopts further measures. It seizes control over production and distribution. For example, during the oil shortage, a new government office, the Federal Energy Administration, was established that had the power to tell the various oil companies how much of each of the various petroleum products they were to produce and to which industries, firms, and regions they were to distribute those products. Thus, government officials decided how much refining capacity should be devoted to producing gasoline, how much to producing heating oil, jet fuel, propane, kerosene, and so forth. In so doing, government officials decided which industries dependent on the various petroleum products would obtain supplies and to what extent. They decided the distribution of each individual product among its various employments, such as how much gasoline would go to truckers, how much to bus lines, and how much would be left for passenger automobiles. They decided which firms in each industry would get how much of the product allotted to that industry. For example, in the airline industry, they decided that each airline would get 90% of the jet fuel it had consumed in the previous year. And they decided which geographical areas would get how much of each product. For example, they decided how much gasoline went to New Jersey and how much to New York. And they were about to decide how much gasoline and heating oil went to each individual consumer. For example, the plan to give every licensed driver over 18 a fixed monthly ration of gasoline by issuing coupons with a picture of George Washington on them. In addition, government officials made it their business to look into the methods of production employed by the users of oil products. For example, they began to try to force electric utilities to switch from burning oil to burning coal in order to reduce oil consumption. Often, these were the same utilities that only a short time before the same government had forced to convert to oil under the influence of the ecology movement. And of course, they reduced highway speed limits, which must be viewed as an interference with methods of production insofar as it applies to trucks and buses or any form of travel for business purposes. Now, all of these further interferences were an unavoidable response to the chaos in the oil industry, given the fact that the government was not prepared to abandon its controls over oil prices. For we have seen how price controls and shortages made the output of the oil industry and the subsequent distribution of that output utterly chaotic. The government took control of production and distribution in the oil industry in an effort to deal with this chaos. Now, under a system of universal price controls, such as existed in World War II, the government is led to seize control over the production and distribution of every commodity. The government thus comes to decide not only all prices and wages, but how much of each item is produced, by what methods, in what locations, and to whom it is distributed. The government fully controls all the inputs that each firm receives, how it combines those inputs, and what it does with the outputs. There is only one appropriate name to describe this state of affairs of full government control over production and distribution, and that is socialism. In seizing control over all production and distribution, the government fully socializes the economic system. The reason the system must be called socialism is because, in fact, the government exercises all of the powers of ownership. The meaning of ownership is the power to determine the use and disposal of property. If the government determines what a firm is to produce, in what quantity, by what methods, and to whom it is to sell its output and at what prices, then it is the government that determines the use and disposal of the firm's property. The government, therefore, becomes the real owner of the firm, the de facto owner. The nominal owners, recognized by the law, that is, the firm's stockholders and also the board of directors chosen by the stockholders and the managers appointed by the board of directors, they are reduced to the status of government functionaries, compelled to carry out the government's orders. The fact that the stockholders may be allowed to draw dividends, strictly limited and controlled by the government, of course, is irrelevant. The status of these stockholders is essentially no different than if the government had openly nationalized their property and given them government bonds on which they received interest. This system of de facto socialism carried out under the outward guise and appearance of capitalism, in which the legal forms of private ownership are maintained, has been aptly characterized by von Mises as socialism on the German or Nazi pattern. The Germans under Ludendorff in World War I and later under Hitler were the foremost practitioners of this type of socialism. The more familiar variant of socialism, in which the government openly nationalizes the means of production and establishes socialism de jure as well as de facto, von Mises calls socialism on the Russian or Bolshevik pattern after its leading practitioners. And I must say, incidentally, in all of the following discussion, I am more indebted to von Mises than in any previous lecture. I want to stress, because everyone should know this, that Nazi Germany was a socialist country and that the Nazis were right to call themselves National Socialists. Nazi is an abbreviation for Nationalsozialist in German. In Nazi Germany, the government controlled all prices and wages and strictly determined what each firm was to produce, how and where it was to produce it, in what quantity, by what methods, and to whom it was to turn over its products. There was no fundamental economic difference between the Nazis and the communists. While the communists in Russia wore red shirts and had 5-year plans, the Nazis in Germany wore brown shirts and had 3-year plans. There is a further point I must make about the use of the term socialism. Socialism means an economic system based on government ownership of the means of production. We have seen that on the basis of this definition, Nazi Germany, a country usually not recognized as socialist, must be categorized as socialist. On the same basis, however, other countries usually thought of as being socialist must not be categorized as socialist. For example, Great Britain, Israel, and Sweden. In these three countries, the economic system is still characterized by private ownership of the means of production. Not only de jure, but de facto private ownership. This private ownership, to be sure, labors under all sorts of restrictions and prohibitions. But still, it is private ownership, and production in these countries is carried out primarily at the initiative of private owners for the sake of private profit. The philosophy of the ruling parties of these countries may be socialist, and socialism may be their ultimate goal, but their actual practice up to now has not been socialism. The correct characterization of these economies is the expression mixed economies, and that term applies to the economy of the United States too. What I mean by a mixed economy is an economy characterized both by private ownership of the means of production and by an extensive list of socialistically motivated acts of government intervention. The only truly socialist countries in the world today are the various communist countries, such as Soviet Russia, Communist China, their various satellites, and perhaps some of the so-called third world countries. No other countries are in fact socialist. Now, from this point on, our discussion of the consequences of price controls becomes a discussion of the consequences of socialism. In studying the consequences of socialism, it does not matter whether we study an economy that has arrived at socialism through price and wage controls, or one that has arrived at socialism openly through the explicit nationalization of all industry. Nor does it matter whether socialism has been brought about peacefully through lawful processes and the observance of democratic procedures, or by means of a violent revolution. Economically, the system is the same in all these cases. Namely, the government owns the means of production, and it is the government's responsibility to decide how they are to be used. That is the essential, common, and defining characteristic of socialism in all cases. Consequently, everything I will have to say about socialism will apply to all variants of socialism, to the socialism of the Nazis, to the socialism of the communists, and to the socialism of the social democrats, such as the late Norman Thomas. What I have to say will apply to any economic system actually based on government ownership of the means of production. Of course, it will not apply to countries such as Britain, Israel, and Sweden, which up to now have not implemented socialism as their actual economic system. I will have two very broad and basic propositions to prove about socialism. The first proposition pertains to the economic consequences of socialism. I will show that if socialism is introduced in response to the chaos created by price controls, its effect is to perpetuate that chaos. If it is introduced without the prior existence of price controls, its effect is to inaugurate that very chaos. More succinctly, the first proposition I will prove is that the economic consequences of socialism are essentially the same as those which result from universal price controls. If you want to know what are the economic consequences of socialism, even if socialism starts with a clean slate without price controls, all you have to do is think back to all of the effects of price controls that we have discovered, and you will have the answer. This, of course, is ironic insofar as the government uses the chaos created by price controls as a pretext for its socialization of the economy. Nevertheless, we have already seen how consistently Soviet Russia provides examples of the effects that follow from universal price controls. I will show that Soviet Russia is such a good source of examples because universal price controls and socialism are fundamentally equivalent in their economic nature and therefore produce the same effects. The second basic proposition that I will prove, and this will be in Lecture 9, is that socialism destroys individual freedom and causes a totalitarian dictatorship. Again, we have abundant examples of the truth of this proposition, namely the whole record of Nazi Germany, Soviet Russia, Communist China, Communist Cuba, and all the other socialist countries. It will only be necessary to demonstrate why the tyrannical conditions in these countries follow from the nature of socialism. Let us turn now to the proof of the first proposition, namely that the economic effects of socialism are essentially the same as the effects of universal price controls. Let us begin by observing the essential economic identity between price controls and socialism. And that is that both of them destroy private ownership of the means of production and its offshoots, the profit motive and the price system. I will repeat, both price controls and socialism destroy private ownership of the means of production and its offshoots, the profit motive and the price system. Observe, price controls destroy the right to bid and ask prices. In a division of labor economy, in which buying and selling are indispensable to production and all other economic activity, the right to bid and ask prices is a fundamental, indispensable right of ownership. Without it, all other rights of ownership are meaningless. For example, the right to own a factory is meaningless if the owner is prohibited from charging or paying prices required to keep the factory in existence. Essentially, price controls are fully as destructive of the rights of ownership as socialism itself. Observe further. What makes price controls produce the chaos they do is precisely the fact that they interfere with the property rights of businessmen. Specifically, they prohibit businessmen from using their capitals in the ways that would be most profitable to themselves. If they did not interfere with the right of businessmen to use their capitals in the most profitable way, then they could produce none of their chaotic effects. Try to imagine the government not interfering with the businessman's property rights and profit motive, and yet the consequences of price controls developing. Think back to lectures 6 and 7 and to the discussion earlier this evening, and recall the following elements of chaos that we saw resulting from price controls. I will only describe them more or less in terms of their outline headings. 1, shortages and the destruction of vital industries. 2, the impotence of consumers accompanied by hatred between buyer and seller. 3, the impetus to higher costs. 4, chaos in the personal distribution of goods to consumers. 5, chaos in the geographical distribution of goods among various local markets. 6, chaos in the distribution of a factor of production among its various uses. 7, chaos in the distribution of capital and labor among the various industries. Now consider, all of these elements of chaos result from just one thing, namely interference with the businessman's property rights and profit motive. For example, would businessmen voluntarily sell their goods too cheaply and thus cause shortages? Obviously not. Their property rights must be violated and they must be forced to do so. Would businessmen abandon the production of vital goods if they were free to charge profitable prices for them? Obviously not. Would they drive away customers offering them profitable business? Again, no. Would they run up the costs of production if those costs came out of profits, as they would have to in the absence of price controls and shortages? Clearly not. Would businessmen saturate some markets at low prices while starving others offering them high prices? Would they use a factor of production to produce some products to excess at low prices while producing not enough of other products offering them high prices? Would they overinvest in some industries at low profits or losses while underinvesting in other industries offering high profits? Again, the answer is clearly no to all of these questions. What makes businessmen behave in these ways is that their property rights are violated, and they are thus prevented from doing what is profitable to themselves. Please observe the wider principle that is emerging, and that is that the entire price system and all of its laws and harmonies depend on one essential fact, namely, the observance of private property rights and thus the freedom of businessmen to act for their own profit. It is private property rights and the profit motive that are the foundation and the motive power that underlie and drive the entire price system. It is they which underlie and actuate all of the benevolent economic laws we observed in our study of the free market back in lectures 3, 4, and 5, namely, the uniformity of profit principle, the various principles of price and wage uniformity, the cost of production principle, the principle that prices are set high enough to limit demand to the supply, and the principle that factors of production are channeled to their most important employments. All of these laws and all of their benevolent consequences are the result of just one thing: private property rights and the profit motive. Now, socialism destroys all property rights. And with them, it destroys the operation of the profit motive and the entire price system. Socialism produces the same chaotic effects as price controls because it destroys the same thing as price controls, namely, the one and only source of economic order and harmony in the world, private property rights and the profit motive. The essential fact to grasp about socialism, which explains why it is essentially identical to price controls, is that it is simply an act of destruction. Like price controls, it destroys private ownership and the profit motive. And that is essentially all it does. It has nothing to put in their place. Socialism, in other words, is not actually an alternative economic system to private ownership of the means of production. It is merely a negation of the system based on private ownership. Now, of course, socialism is not usually perceived simply as a negation. The first economist fully to grasp the destructive nature of socialism was von Mises, and he has not had many followers. Much more often, socialism is perceived as a source of economic order and harmony. In fact, the most popular synonym for socialism is, quote, economic planning. The belief in socialism's ability to plan is why a government turns to socialism when confronted with the chaos created by price controls. Indeed, the belief in socialism's ability to plan may be one of the reasons for instituting price controls in the first place, namely as a deliberate step leading directly to socialism. Certainly, the belief in socialism's ability to plan is a powerful factor in the popularity of socialism. Without it, it would be difficult for socialism to find supporters. Nevertheless, a socialist government is helpless to bring order out of the chaos created by price controls. And if price controls do not exist when it assumes power, then it proceeds to create the same chaos as price controls by the very fact of socializing the economic system. For the great joke of socialism, of planning as it is called, is that it cannot plan, that it destroys planning and substitutes chaos. Why socialism cannot plan is the question we will deal with following the break. Please let us make this a short break. In order to understand why socialism cannot plan, we must look again at capitalism. This will enable us to form an idea of what is required for economic planning, and therefore why socialism is incapable of it. Please observe, under capitalism, each individual engages in economic planning. I must stress this fact, and I am going to give you a very extensive list of examples of it, because it is very important, and because socialist propaganda has created exactly the opposite impression in the minds of most people. It has created the impression that what individuals do under capitalism is run about like chickens without heads in an anarchy of production. And that rational action, planned action, is a prerogative of government. The truth is that each individual under capitalism is engaged in economic planning almost continuously. Unfortunately, most of us are in the position of Monsieur Jourdain, who spoke prose without ever knowing it. We are all engaged in economic planning under capitalism practically every day, but hardly any of us realize it, least of all the intellectuals. Let us see in just what ways we practice economic planning. An individual is engaged in economic planning when he plans how much of his wealth and income to save and invest, and how much of it to consume. When he plans where to invest it and in what ways to consume it. He is engaged in economic planning, for example, when he plans to put his money in a bank or in the stock market, and in which specific shares in the stock market. When he plans to buy more clothes or a new stereo, even when he plans to drive to work or take the train instead. Every businessman under capitalism is engaged in economic planning when he plans to expand or contract the production of any item, when he plans to introduce a new product or discontinue an old product, when he plans to change his methods of production or retain his existing methods, when he plans to build a new factory or not replace an existing one, when he plans to change the location of his business or let it remain where it is, when he plans to buy new machinery or not, to add to his inventories or not, to hire additional workers or let some of his present workers go. Every wage earner under capitalism is engaged in economic planning when he plans to seek new employment or to retain his present employment, when he plans to improve his skills or rest content with those he has, when he plans to do his job in one particular area of the country or in one particular industry rather than in another. In short, every one of us under capitalism is engaged in economic planning every time he plans any aspect of his personal finances or business affairs. We are engaged in economic planning every time we think about a course of action that would benefit us in our capacity as a buyer or seller. It is simply amazing that all of this planning could be overlooked and that the socialists have been able to proceed as though capitalism lacked planning. Capitalism has planning, the planning of each and every person who participates in the economic system. Now let us observe another equally important fact, namely that the planning of capitalism, which, as I say, takes place on the part of everyone, is based on prices. Prices have a twofold function in the planning of capitalism. First, they enable the individual planner of capitalism to perform economic calculations. That is, they enable him to compute the money cost and/or money revenue of various modes of conduct. If the planner is a businessman, he weighs a money cost against a money revenue. If he is a consumer, he weighs a money cost against a personal satisfaction. If he is a wage earner, he weighs a money revenue against his personal efforts. These economic calculations provide a standard of action for the planner under capitalism. They tell the businessman to produce the products and use the methods of production that are anticipated to be the most profitable. They tell consumers to consume in the ways that other things equal occasion the lowest cost. And they tell wage earners to work in the jobs that other things equal pay the highest wages. Thus, prices are an indispensable guide both to the planning of production and to the living of one's personal life under capitalism. Now, the second corollary function of prices is that they coordinate the plans of each individual under capitalism with the plans of all other individuals. That is, prices serve to make each individual adjust his own plans to the relevant plans of all other individuals in the economic system. In this way, capitalism and the price system bring about a harmoniously integrated planning of the entire economic system. Our whole discussion of the free market's price system demonstrated this process of coordination and mutual adjustment. It is only necessary to say the following by way of summary of that discussion. Namely, that concern with money revenue makes one adjust to the plans of the prospective buyers of one's goods or services, and to the plans of all competing and even potentially competing sellers of those goods and services. And that concern with money costs makes one adjust to the plans of all other buyers seeking either the things one buys or the factors of production from which they are made, and to the plans of sellers in their capacity as individuals having definite personal values and preferences. For example, the desire to earn a higher money revenue leads one to produce things that buyers want and that are not being produced excessively by other sellers. The desire to incur lower costs leads one to economize on things that other buyers value or which can be provided only at some special inconvenience to the sellers engaged in producing them. To grasp this point, all you have to do is realize that you take account of prices and think of how those prices are determined. Now, socialism, in destroying the price system, destroys the possibility of economic calculation and the coordination of the activities of separate, independent planners. It therefore makes rational planning impossible and creates chaos. As an illustration of the consequences, consider the problems confronting a socialist government in trying to plan the production of a simple item, such as shoes. Shoes can be produced in varying quantities, in various styles or combinations of styles, by various methods, such as by machine or by hand, and in different combinations of machine and hand production. They can be produced from different materials or combinations of materials, such as leather, rubber, and canvas, and in different geographical locations, again, in varying proportions. Under capitalism, all of these choices are determined on the basis of economic calculations. Thus, shoe production as a whole tends to be carried to the point where further production would make the shoe industry relatively unprofitable in comparison to other industries. The styles are those which the consumers are willing to make profitable. The methods of production, the materials used, the geographical locations are all the lowest cost, except insofar as they provide special advantages for which the consumers are willing to bear the extra cost. Under socialism, the lack of economic calculation makes it impossible to make any of these choices on a rational basis. The extent of attempted shoe production is determined arbitrarily, most likely on the basis of some official's judgment about how many pair of shoes are, quote, necessary per 1,000 inhabitants, or some such criterion. Style is determined arbitrarily, according to what suits the tastes of those in charge. The methods, materials, and locations planned must be selected arbitrarily. And then, in large part, for reasons that will soon become clearer, the actual carrying out of production, as opposed to what is called for in the plans, may very well have to be undertaken on the accidental basis of the means of production that happen to be available. Now, the decisions about all of these choices, quantity, styles, methods, and so on, are important not only from the standpoint of the consumers of shoes, but no less from the standpoint of the production of all other goods. Please bear in mind that shoe production, or the production of any good whatever, requires factors of production which are thereby made unavailable for other purposes. Shoe production requires labor that could be employed elsewhere. It requires leather or other material that either might be employed elsewhere or which is produced by labor that could certainly be employed elsewhere. In the same way, the tools or machines required, or the labor and the materials used to make them, have alternative employments. Moreover, each of the different choices respecting shoe production makes a different combination of factors of production unavailable for alternative employments. For example, shoes produced by hand reduce the number of handicraft workers available for other purposes. Those produced by machine reduce the number of machine makers and the amount of fuel available for other purposes. Shoes produced in Minsk leave less labor available for other purposes in Minsk than if they were produced in Pinsk, and so on. It is therefore clearly not enough, as most socialists appear to believe, for a socialist government, having inherited or stolen the technology of shoe production, to simply decide how many shoes to produce, determine on a style, quality, method, and locations for production, and then give the orders to produce them. In planning the production of shoes or any other individual item, a socialist government is logically obliged to consider its effect on the production of all other items. It is logically obliged to try to plan the production of shoes or any good in a way that least impairs the production of other goods. In drafting its plans for shoe production, a socialist government is obliged to consider the extent of shoe production in relation to the production of all other goods using the same factors of production. It is obliged to consider such questions as whether shoe production might be expanded with factors of production drawn from the production of some other good, and whether the production of that other good might be maintained by drawing factors of production from a third good, and so on. For example, it must consider whether it would be advisable to use more labor in Minsk for shoes and less for making clothing, say, and perhaps to expand clothing production in Pinsk at the expense of some third good. It must consider all of the industries using any of the factors of production used in the shoe industry. It must consider what depends on the output of those industries and what alternative factors of production are available to those industries. Indeed, it must go even further. It must consider all of the industries using the alternative factors of production. It must consider what depends on their products and what further alternative factors of production may be available to them, and so on. And at each step, it must consider the possibility of expanding the overall supply of the factor of production in question, and if so, by what means and at the expense of what. To make these problems real, let us continue with the example of shoes. In order to plan shoe production rationally, it would be necessary for a socialist government to consider all of the alternative employments of each of the factors of production used to produce shoes. Let us start just with leather. In planning shoe production rationally, a socialist government would have to consider the alternative employments of leather, such as upholstering furniture and providing belting for machinery. It would have to consider the consequences of having more or less furniture and machinery versus more or less shoes. It would have to consider alternatives to the use of leather in upholstering furniture and making belting for machinery. For example, various fabrics and plastic and steel. It would have to consider the alternative uses for the various fabrics and for the plastic and steel. It would have to consider what depended on those alternative uses and what substitutes were available for them. It would have to consider whether the total supply of leather or its substitutes should be expanded, and if so, by what means, where, and at the expense of what. Then, of course, the socialist government would be obliged to repeat the same process for all of the other factors of production employed to produce shoes, or which potentially could be employed to produce shoes. All of this raises the insuperable difficulty of socialist planning. Namely, under socialism, it is necessary to plan the production of the entire economic system as an indivisible whole. That would be the only rational procedure. But the planning of the economic system as an indivisible whole is simply impossible. It would require a superhuman intellect to be able to grasp the physical connections among all the various industries and to be able to trace the consequences of alterations in any one industry on all the others. What would be required for the rational planning of a socialist economy would be the existence of an omniscient deity willing to descend from heaven and assume the management of the socialist economy. This deity would have to be able to hold in mind at one time a precise inventory of the quantities and qualities of all the different factors of production in the economic system, together with their exact geographical locations and a full knowledge of the various technological possibilities open to them. That is to say, it would have to be able to hold in mind at one time all of the millions of separate farms, factories, mines, warehouses, and so forth, down to the last repair shop, together with a knowledge of the quantity and quality of all the machines, tools, materials, and half-finished goods that they contained, and exactly what they were capable, what they were potentially capable of accomplishing, and when. It would then have to be able to project forward in time all of the different new combinations of factors of production that might be produced out of the existing factors, together with where and precisely when they would come into existence, and the technological possibilities that would then be open to them. It would have to be able to make this projection for an extended period of time, say a generation or more, in order to avoid the possibly wasteful production of machines and buildings lasting that long. And then, out of the virtually infinite number of different possible permutations and combinations of what might be produced, it would have to pick one that on some undefined and undefinable basis it considered best, and then order it to be undertaken. That would be its economic plan. That is what would be required to even begin to duplicate what capitalism accomplishes through the price system. For observe, under capitalism, different individuals in combination, that is when their knowledge is added together, do know the precise quantities, qualities, locations, and technological possibilities open to all the various factors of production in the economic system. And everybody's production is based on the sum of all of this knowledge, because this knowledge is reflected in the prices of all the various factors of production and products. For example, the price of wheat at any given time reflects the knowledge of each owner of wheat concerning the amount, quality, and location of the wheat he owns. It also reflects the knowledge of each user of wheat about the technological possibilities open to wheat. All of this knowledge enters into the supply and demand, and hence the price of wheat. It is the same with every other good. Its price reflects the sum of existing knowledge about the amount of it available, the technological possibilities open to it in production, and every other relevant consideration. And the future supply, locations, and production possibilities of factors of production are taken into account in the anticipation of their future prices.